Siding Unlimited, named the best window installers, not just here, but in the whole USA. Get the best. Siding Unlimited, 5-time winner as America's best window installer. For windows you call Siding Unlimited, first and directly, SidingUnlimited.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios in downtown Milwaukee, it's Wisconsin's Midday News, making stories come to life. Now, here are your hosts, Jessica Tye, and in for Greg Metzig, it's Adam Roberts.
Big developments in the Hannah Dugan case. Let's get right to it.
And now it's time for three big things on Wisconsin's Midday News.
Number one, the jury in the federal trial of Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan is very close to starting deliberations. Closing arguments are happening now. To give you a little summary here, the prosecution says Dugan was not confused about the courthouse's arrest protocol. They say she was a frustrated and angry judge who was fed up and decided to corruptly take matters into her own hands. The defense says they're trying to make an example of Judge Dugan. The defense started calling witnesses this morning and was done very quickly in less than an hour. Judge Dugan did not take the stand in her own defense. We talked with WISN-TV political reporter Matt Smith about the decision. He was in the courtroom as the jury realized they would not hear directly from Dugan.
They called four witnesses this morning, a couple of judges, and then the former Milwaukee mayor, Tom Barrett, as a character witness. The defense itself officially told the judge after the jury was out of the room that she wouldn't testify, but obviously you can put two and two together. So there was no like direct proclamation with the jury present. They just now know that she won't testify. The defense must feel confident where they're at, or they just don't see any benefit at this time in terms of putting her on the stand at the end of all these days of testimony.
Dugan is accused of helping a man who was in the country illegally evade immigration agents at the Milwaukee County Courthouse in April. If convicted, Dugan faces up to 6 years in prison.
Number two, we're still searching for what could become of the former Northridge Mall site on Milwaukee's northwest side. The site has since been rebranded as Granville Station. It's a pretty big site, the largest available real estate plot in the city, around 58 acres in size. City leaders earlier today providing a slight update on progress. Alderwoman Laressa Taylor, who represents the area, says the community has been quick to put forth some ideas for what could go there.
More than 40% of the ideas focused on sports, recreation, on also walkable mixed use for the area, a job training center, hospitals, health center, grocery stores, and even a farmer's market.
So a lot of ideas, but no concrete plans. Mayor Cavalier Johnson was asked by reporters today if anyone had put forth any concrete requests for proposals. The city says that has not been the case. Northridge Mall, of course, vacant since 2003, demolished earlier this year. There'll be a public meeting in January, and coming up at 2:16, we'll be joined by Mayor Johnson in the studio to dig further into what could become of the former mall site, and whether, as the city has said, truly anything is on the table.
Number three, in President Trump's primetime speech last night, he spent much of the time deflecting blame on the state of our economy. Here's ABC Chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl.
If the president was addressing a crisis last night, it seemed to be a crisis of confidence in his handling of the economy. Americans are overwhelmingly unhappy with the state of the economy, and a clear majority in many recent polls are blaming Donald Trump.
In one poll released just hours ahead of the president's address, 57% of people said they disapprove of Trump's handling of the economy. And while the president recently gave the economy an A++++, in this poll, only 3% of Americans said they think the state of the economy is excellent. It is 1:15 right now. Coming up, why children kill their parents. The idea that a child could murder their own parents is almost impossible to comprehend. Patricide makes up just 1 to 2% of homicides, yet it happens nearly once a day in this country. Addiction is often at the center of these tragedies, slowly destroying families long before violence erupts. Brad Garrett is a former FBI agent who spent years supervising offenders battling severe substance abuse. He's seen firsthand how long-term addiction erodes empathy, fuels narcissism, and can redirect rage to the people closest to you, often parents. Brad joins us now to help explain what may drive these unthinkable acts and the warning signs families should never ignore. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
You're welcome, Jessica.
So put this into perspective for us. Patricide is statistically rare, yet it happens with unsettling regularity. From your experience, what separates these cases from other domestic homicides?
So typically what happens is that, and drug addiction obviously is one component of why kids kill themselves. Actually, the biggest number are kids that are abused physically, sexually, emotionally. They just can't take the abuse any longer, and they kill their parents. A different dynamic, different motivation than probably applies to this case with Rob and Michelle Reiner. You know, you have a son that's, because their life has been so much in the public eye, including 10 years ago or so, making a movie that basically talks about Nick, the son's addiction. And, you know, there were podcasts and there's a lot of information out there about them, the family, his addiction. And think about how long this addiction has been going on. I mean, sure. At 14, apparently, he'd been in multiple rehabs. He's now 32. So half his life has been based around addiction. And beyond the toll, both mentally and physically, it takes on the addicted person, just think what it takes of living with somebody off and on, with somebody. I mean, they destroy families because they're so narcissistic, so demanding, so, they pull the oxygen out of their room day in and day out, just complaining and hostile and angry and mean, et cetera. So you can imagine what they've dealt with in the last 20 years. So if you start with that, the question is, how does a child, this case, an adult child, end up so brutally? I mean, this is, if you look at the average how kids kill their parents case, it's usually shooting. And if it's a younger kid, it's almost always shooting. Awful enough, of course. But nothing compared to stabbing, according to the coroner, medical examiner, multiple times, your parents. The level of rage here is off the charts. So how do you get to that point? It's typically the following. This builds up. It's cumulative. Because now he's 32. He has no job. He has no education. He has no future. He has nothing. And so his anger and rage and hostility towards his parents, who are super successful, and kind, it appears. He resents all that. And when he asks for something, now you got to keep in mind, he's asking from a person who's probably demanding it, expects to be fed, expects to have extra money, expects to have the ability to buy drugs. Parents are going to shut you off at some point. So there's going to be this off and on switch that I think has occurred multiple times. But in his case, something big happened. Not big for the rest of us, but certainly big looking through the eyes of Nick, assuming he's the right person. This is all allegations at this point. He has been charged. But the point being, from a vantage point of somebody that's 32, drug addicted, dependent on their parents, you're going to focus all your hostility and rage on them. Not logical, makes no sense at all. But let's face it, drug addicts aren't logical.
Brad, experts often identify three categories of children who kill their parents. Can you explain those categories and why the antisocial personality group can be so dangerous?
Sure. So I mentioned earlier to you that kids that are abused fit into this category of killing their parents. And you can, I guess, understand that to a certain extent. But then you fall into these people that are acutely antisocial, which almost invariably all the drug addicts I dealt with in probation and parole, we're all narcissistic, self-serving, trying to get other people to help them. It's all about manipulation, control, and getting what you want without working for it. And so Nick may well fit that category. The third category are people that are severely mentally ill, like psychotic. I think that's a small number. I'm not sure it fits this case. We'll have to see. But that's the three categories. And I just think that he reached a point where his anger and rage toward his parents reached such a point. And also keep in mind, all of this drug use makes you much more impulsive and much more immediate in your behaviors of impulse control kind of gone. So you add all this up over 15 years, and you end up, sadly, what happened, it looks like Saturday night, Sunday morning, over the weekend.
Families often live with years of chaos before something catastrophic happens. What warning signs should never be ignored when addiction turns hostile or threatening?
So typically you'll see more extreme behavior, more depression, more anger, more rage, more separation from the child to the parents. And, you know, keep in mind they have all this history before you get to this maybe even further downward turn, for lack of better terms, of their mental health, which in some interviews I've read, friends of the family said that Michelle was particularly concerned that he was sort of degrading mentally, whatever that means.
And so
is that a warning sign? Sure. Now, is that a warning sign that he's about to kill you? It's probably not, because let's face it, there are millions of families that are facing versions of what we're talking about where nobody's going to get killed. I mean, many of these cases end up where adult children just kill themselves. And so you have that. But, you know, yes, there are warning signs. Yes, there are ways that mental health people will train parents at how to act, setting boundaries, cutting them off financially. And, you know, all those things may short-term work, but it's really hard for any of this stuff to work long-term if, in fact, you have a child that's just not willing to actually stop using drugs.
When I think about the Reiners case, I feel for the struggle that they were probably feeling, because many parents feel trapped between helping their child and protecting themselves in these extreme cases. What advice would you give families who fear their addicted child may be becoming dangerous?
Becoming dangerous, and also, as you pointed out, destroying their own life, their own ability to function normally. And in this case, there's two other kids. There's an older brother and a younger sister. And, you know, sadly, the younger sister found her parents in this state, apparently, according to LAPD.
Yes,
so,
tragic.
So you have all that. It's just an awful situation. And even though one a day is far too many, at least it's not a huge number.
Yeah. Brad, as this case moves forward towards trial, what key psychological or behavioral evidence will likely matter most in understanding what happened here?
So I think the prosecution would obviously have to sort of build the case through people who have witnessed Nick in certain situations, who knows about his drugs addiction, who knows about other threats or hostility he's made against his parents. And then obviously the evidence of, you know, is there CCTV going to, he was staying at the guest house, which I guess is next to the main house. So for him to be there would have been normal, but you know, when did he go in the house? When did he leave? How was he found when LAPD? What evidence did they have? Is he still in the same clothes, which would probably translate into they've got blood on them? You know, is it their blood? Is it his blood? We just don't know what state he was in when LAPD picked him up. All of that will play into a case where, you know, is this a case if you're the defense attorney, you'd want to go to trial? This would be a tough trial to win. But, you know, we'll see. He's got a very talented defense attorney, so we'll see where it goes.
Former FBI agent Brad Garrett, always great perspective. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care, Jessica.
Well, I just mentioned I was checking out the traffic cameras here, and it's wet, misty. You know, you got the wetness from the roads just coming on up on the windshields. It's kind of gross out there. It's also very mild, though.
That's right. Upper 40s right now, although, as we'll talk about here, that is not going to be the case for long. The deep dive below freezing is coming up here shortly and could have some impacts on your drive home tonight.
Yeah, that's right. Our temperatures, they are going to dive. Let's check in with Chief Meteorologist Brian Iznanski over at TMJ4. I guess if people are liking this warmth, don't get used to it. Right, Brian?
Yeah, it's going to be short-lived. We got a lot going on that's going to happen here over the next 6 hours here in southeastern Wisconsin. Some big changes on the way, but you're right. Today, so far mild and just rainfall and still some rain moving through the area.
So what do we need to know about the snow squalls? Because when we talked to you yesterday, that was a significant concern for the late afternoon and evening hours. Has anything changed with that?
There has been some changes with that. Still some potential, but it looks like a later arrival of the colder air and the snow showers, which in general should minimize the official snow squall threat. Not completely take it away, but what you have there with the later arrival is in order to get to achieve like snow squall status, that whiteout heavy burst of snow, you need, and we talked about a little bit about this yesterday, you need the formation of convection, which basically is rising air. You need some sort of vertical lifting going on. And that is a lot harder to achieve after sunset. After, you know, our warming of the day. It still can happen. You still can initialize that convective band of precipitation prior, further upstream. Like, let's say it fires off earlier in the evening or late afternoon over towards La Crosse. That could still progress its way in. However, the fuel won't be there as much with a later arrival for snow squall. But with that said, still a heavier burst of a brief burst of snow possible later on this evening. But the timing is probably looking more between 7 and 9 o'clock for most of southeastern Wisconsin.
And then not to forget or gloss over the fact is that, oh, by the way, the temperatures will drop. And we've had several days now of melting snow. I saw the grass in my neighborhood for the first time in what felt like three weeks. And so that water is going to be around, and suddenly you get below 32 degrees, and squall or no squall, the drive could still be tricky tonight as those temperatures drop.
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you have a later commute especially, we're going to see what I think will qualify as a flash freeze across southeastern Wisconsin, where you have a lot of water on the ground right now, and temperatures will quickly dip from the 40s to the 30s and eventually the 20s in a matter of a few hours. So we still, right now we're probably peaking with our temperature, but soon we're going to be in the 30s in the next couple hours. And then I think dipping below freezing probably by 6 o'clock or so, and then we'll continue to go down from there. So especially if you have that later commute, that's where the potential will be for some icing on the roadways, and then throw in the potential for a heavier snow shower. So yeah, a lot going on, tumbling temperatures, flash freeze potential, and still some potential for a snow squall. Now, if we do, if the Weather Service determines that we meet that snow squall criteria, which again is whiteout conditions, and it has to be for a short period of time. Again, these snow squalls are never about how much snow. It's about how quick it comes and how quick it moves out. If we do, a snow squall warning is typically issued for like a small area. Your WEA emergency alert would go off on your phone if you are within that area that is warned for that. So if you're driving along and you hear your phone go off and you have a snow squall warning, that's a big deal. Like that's the point of you probably, if you have the means to do so, and don't do it frantically, but pull off the freeway, pull off the highway, stop at Quick Trip if you want to, let it pass through. You don't want to be caught out. The point of sending that alert out is because you don't want to be caught out on the highways when that hits, because it hits so fast.
Good advice there. And so we're talking about the wind as well tonight. Once we get past all this messiness, what about tomorrow? Is the wind going to stick around still, and how cold will it be?
It is. So the winds, we barely talked about the wind. Yeah, the winds are going to ramp up this afternoon. We could get some gusts, 40 miles per hour across southeastern Wisconsin, and look for that to continue tonight and into tomorrow. Tomorrow looks windy, and it will be chilly. We're talking about highs in the 20s, so when you factor in a 20, 30-mile-an-hour wind, it's going to feel like the single digits at times. So back to winter again tomorrow, and then we work our way back up on Saturday.
Such a busy day, so everybody pack your patience and be careful. Thank you so much. It's Chief Meteorologist Brian Iznansky over at TMJ4. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, sounds good, guys. We'll see you.
It's 1:43 up next, your weekly wellness check.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
No. Time for our weekly wellness check with Dr. Ben Weston, Chief Health Policy Advisor for Milwaukee County and Associate Professor of the Medical College of Wisconsin. Happy Thursday, Dr. Weston.
Happy Thursday. Good to be with you.
The holidays are coming up here soon. I want to get to this, though, right off the bat, because we did have some breaking news today. We learned that two kids in Wisconsin have died from respiratory illnesses, one from COVID, the other from flu. And right now you have, you know, the holidays almost in full swing here. You've got a lot of people traveling over the next few weeks, spending more time with friends and family. And with that often comes an increased chance of spreading illnesses like the flu. What signs and symptoms of the flu should we be looking for?
Yeah, it's always hard seeing these cases when we first start out the year, but unfortunately we do see them every year. Now, one thing to know about flu is that it can hit suddenly. You may feel fine one day, but we wake up the next feeling kind of crummy. You got the fevers, the chills, the cough, the sore throat, body aches. Sometimes in kids, you even get the vomiting and diarrhea as well. Now, if you're having just mild symptoms, usually over-the-counter medications, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, or Tylenol can help reduce those fever and ease your symptoms. But if you're getting more serious symptoms, and particularly if you're in a higher risk group and you get flu, there are prescription antivirals such as Tamiflu. And these can not just lessen symptoms and shorten the time you're sick, but most importantly, they can prevent that progression to severe disease that can affect certain people.
Also, of course, this time of year, doctor, as people are planning those holiday gatherings, they may be starting to feel the sniffles or starting to feel off and be telling themselves, I'm going to put off that doctor visit. I can't do that right now. But if someone is having those flu-like symptoms, when should they, regardless of how they feel inside, go to get that look at their doctor's office?
Yeah, so it really depends. Now, some populations are at higher risk for severe flu and flu-related complications. So we're talking really young kids, adults over 65, those who are pregnant, those who are immunocompromised or have chronic diseases. Think of asthma, heart disease, lung disease. Now, if you're in one of these high-risk groups, it's important to contact your doctor right when flu symptoms begin so that you can get the right medications and the right care. Now, if you're otherwise healthy, you may still want to seek medical care if certain symptoms are getting serious, things like trouble breathing or high fever, for example. But if you're in doubt, if you're worried, you can always check in with your healthcare provider to see what's best for you.
Where is Wisconsin right now as far as our flu activity, and what are the best ways to protect ourselves?
Yeah, so flu activity is currently low, but certainly we're seeing more and more flu. So we're getting toward, but not at the peak of flu season. We're just starting to ramp up here. And really, the best way to protect yourself, of course, is getting that annual flu shot. Now, hopefully you've gotten it already. We're getting pretty late in the season. But flu strains change every year, so staying up to date gives you the best protection. And even though we're late, it still is worth getting. You can still build up that protection before we hit the peak of flu season. Now, one common misconception, it doesn't contain live virus. You can't get the flu from the flu shot. Now, in addition to flu shots, good hygiene, of course, as with anything. Washing your hands often, covering your coughs and sneezes, and avoiding close contact with folks who are sick. Or if you're sick, just staying home.
You know, Doc, as we look at other concerns with winter and our health, we just had Chief Meteorologist Brian Nesnansky talking about the dip in temperatures we're going to see. We've had a lot of warm weather that's melted a lot of snow, leading to ponding of water. And that water is going to turn into ice overnight, creating some dangerous conditions, not just on the roads, as we've talked a lot about, but as we're walking around. If you're on the sidewalk outside your home or doing some shopping outside downtown, there's going to be ice on the sidewalks, and that oftentimes leads to serious injuries from falling down. Just how common are injuries related to winter weather falls and ice on the sidewalks?
Yeah, they're really common, actually. So each year, more than 1 million Americans are injured by slipping on snow or ice. And about 17,000 of those end up being fatal. So these aren't just little slips and falls. Now, in the emergency department, we see certain groups that have higher risk of falling. As you can imagine, older adults. Also kids. Now, kids tend to bounce back a little better. And then workers who spend time outdoors. Think of those delivery drivers that are running your packages up and down. It's an occupational hazard to be slipping in those sort of jobs.
So as an ED physician, emergency department, what kinds of slips and fall injuries do you tend to see the most during your winter months?
Yeah, so when they get to the point of coming into the emergency department, usually there's some sort of an injury. We hope for a sprain or a strain, but certainly we see a lot of broken bones. And of course, you know, back and spinal injuries as well. Now, what we really worry about are head injuries. So traumatic brain injuries, they're more serious and they can certainly impact your overall health long term. So if you do hit your head, whether it's falling or something else, some of the red flags you want to watch for, It means you need immediate medical care. If you lose consciousness, that's more severe. If you have a really bad headache after the fall, certainly if you're vomiting, if you're confused or disoriented, if you're on blood thinning medications, those would be some of the reasons, among others, to definitely seek out medical care for that fall. So all sorts of different presentations come into the emergency department, though.
And obviously, the solution to avoiding those falls is not hoping that everyone in your neighborhood throws the salt out before the ice forms. So how can someone prevent a fall caused by snow and ice?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, part of it is just assuming there's always ice out there when it's cold out, especially now when it's wet out and everything looks kind of shiny and you can't tell quite what's going on. Now, particularly if you're more prone to falls, some of the things you want to do. So one is the way you walk. You want to walk like a penguin. You're using short, kind of slow, shuffling steps. You have your knees a little bit bent to help with that center of gravity and that balance, and you have your arms out for balance. You want to avoid keeping your hands in your pockets. My kids do this all the time. You don't want to walk on ice with your hands in your pockets. Keep your hands out. There's handrails available. Use those. Of course, you want shoes that have good traction. And believe it or not, if you do fall, there is a way to fall safely to reduce serious injuries. So certainly bending your knees, getting closer to the ground, not reaching that outstretched hand out if you can avoid it, to avoid, you know, those broken wrists and broken arms. Trying to fall on your side, it's a little cushionier part of your body usually. And of course, protecting your head, trying to prevent that from hitting the ground. But the best thing is probably just slow down. Take extra time to go where you are going. You don't always have to be in a hurry.
Yeah, without a doubt. Milwaukee recorded its coldest December start in nearly 50 years. It's mild today, but we know those temps are, they're just going to plunge later on tonight. For those who enjoy an outdoor run or hike, let's talk about the risks and the benefits as well to exercising in the cold. What happens to your body when you exercise in cold weather?
Yeah, so when you're out in the cold, your body shifts into this heat preservation mode. So we've all experienced it. Your blood vessels, especially your hands, your feet, your face, they're constricting. And that's to keep the warm blood closer to your heart, to your brain, to protect those vital organs. That's why your hands and your feet get so cold when you're out in cold weather. But this also affects our muscles. Your muscles rapidly cool down and they just get less flexible, less pliable. And that makes us more prone to strains or injuries. And then we've all experienced when you breathe in that cold, dry air, it can kind of irritate. Even if you don't have lung issues, it can make you cough. And certainly if you do have lung issues, it can exacerbate those as well. So it's not that the cold weather necessarily in short term is harmful to our bodies, but it changes how our body responds and can impact how we exercise and what we should do when exercising in the cold.
So then how do we best prepare? Because I think if the activity is a run or a hike, you may say, oh, we'll dress with more layers, but you're also running. And I know I run hot all the time. So if I'm going to be running out, I'm sometimes tempted to just tank top, shorts, and shoes, and let's go. But that may not be the best idea.
I hear you. I tend to have the same approach, but it may not be best. And so you want to prepare your body for that cold weather. So certainly warm up. 5-10 minutes of movement, ideally. Walking, marching, dynamic stretches. Do it outside so you're starting to get used to that colder weather. And then keeping yourself as warm as possible. Dress in layers. You can always take them off. Get that base layer. Get something windproof, waterproof on the outside. And then don't forget about hydration. It's easy to forget in the winter when it's not as hot out. But cold weather dulls your thirst. But you are still losing fluid when you're sweating, when you're breathing. And so keep yourself hydrated by drinking water, even if you're not feeling thirsty.
That's Dr. Ben Weston with our weekly wellness check. Thanks so much, Dr. Weston.
All right. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.